family, and I also love what I do. My mother tells me I have always taken the hard road, but it would be more accurate to say I have not chosen the easy one. It would have been easier not to have had so many children, for example, but much less fun, exciting, and joyful. There are strange moments. I find myself putting on washing machine loads covering the individual colours of the rainbow, rather than just dark or light. Yes, I have done orange washes. Packing for holidays, 11 pairs of flip-flops, is another logistical challenge, but a small price to pay. It's important to think of work as part of your life, not separate from life, not least because we spend so much time working. Technology has been a great enabler. At the beginning of my career, there was no internet, no mobile phones, and the limitations on staying in touch outside the office were very restrictive. Now, of course, we may struggle to switch off, but in theory we have much more flexibility. In practice, many businesses still have a culture of presenteeism, the pressure to come to the office, to sit at your desk. We need to keep demonstrating that we can do a great job wherever we are, that it's our output that matters. I have become more confident about that, but know we still have to keep showing that agile working helps make us most productive. Secondly, we need to be clear about what really matters to us and make that sacrosanct. For my family, it's been important that I get home most nights in time for family supper. If we have two, or sometimes three, because of travel, evenings without that time, the dynamic shifts. We all feel a bit destabilized. I feel unhappy. The children get stressed, and even the amazingly patient Richard gets worn down. Four, do you worry about failing? I am completely normal, so yes, the fear of failure is there. But I have also learned to recognize that every day is full of triumphs and disasters. And as Rudyard Kipling said in his wonderful poem, If, we need to treat those two imposters just the same. I do and will fail. It may seem a frivolous example, but I recently made a pavlova, well, I tried, for an extended family lunch. Usually this is one of the very few dishes I can easily make, with or without help from my daughters. On this occasion it took 3 attempts and 24 eggs. We had a lot of scrambled eggs using the yolks that week, to make even a passable meringue, and even then it needed restyling as eaten mess. The pavlova is crushed and mixed with strawberries and cream. After the first 2 flops, I completely overreacted. The failed meringues became a motif for all the things I felt I was getting wrong in my life. As Richard told me, it was a reminder of the importance of coping with failure, whether big or small. 5. How do I get started in my career if I don't know the right people, or I'm not even sure what I want to do? You need practical help. Do not be afraid of asking. Even if you, your friends and family know absolutely nobody in the field you're interested in, it is possible to create leads. Write to people. In particular, showcase any difference. If you are the first person in your family to go to university, make that clear. Make it an advantage, not an obstacle. See if your school can get someone in the industry along to speak. In the UK, there are great organisations like Speakers for Schools that can help. I have spoken at schools where young people have written to me afterwards, very specifically requesting my help, and I always like the way they take the initiative. If I can help, I will. The apprenticeship schemes offered by many companies and industry are another way of getting that first break. We all need someone to take a chance on us early on. The key is to demonstrate that you might have something they may not already have. 6. Do you think it's harder making progress in a male-dominated industry, or the opposite? As my own experience suggests, this really can cut both ways. It can be lonely, and it's easy to feel excluded, even if this is in no way intended by your colleagues, but you can also be noticed more easily. I would not discourage anyone from following their dream if it happens to be in an industry that is male-dominated. Just be aware. Do not take it for granted that your skills and efforts will be recognized, and seek to make a deliberate impact. Whatever you do, do not just try to be like the boys. I do worry about the risk of positive discrimination. A brilliant man should not be overlooked in favour of a less talented woman, and if that's being considered, it means that business leaders or other selectors aren't really thinking about what we're trying to achieve through encouraging diversity. Excluding people just because of their gender, race or sexual orientation, if they are male, white and straight, takes us right back to where we started. Ultimately, the emphasis on a person's identity should lessen, but for now we do need to call people out if they are biasing selection against talent of the wrong sort. It makes no sense to try to solve one form of injustice by applying another. 7. How can you tell what a company's culture is like in advance? What do you do if you experience sexual harassment or discrimination? Trying to accurately gauge a company's culture from the outside is tricky. You are looking for clues and corroboration. Ask as many people as you can, ideally including recent joiners as well as your interviewers, and read widely to see what's said about the company. I am skeptical, however, about anonymous reviews. Quite simply, ask, how would you describe the culture? If the words used are broadly consistent from one future colleague to the next, it is an encouraging sign that what they were saying is really lived and breathed. If the answers fit in with what's valuable to you, go for it. There may well be individuals who are rogue within the firm, but if the core is strong, that will prevail. If it turns out that the reality is quite different, then my general advice is to learn quickly and move on. But if you experience genuine sex discrimination, such as becoming aware you are being paid less than a man doing the same job, or harassment, please speak up rather than just leave. You have a voice, and these days it will be heard. By coming forward, you can improve the situation for both yourself and others. How you escalate a problem is important, though. The Me Too campaign that followed after the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke may have dramatically made the point that sexual harassment goes way beyond one man, industry, or country, but tweeting about your specific problem at work is unlikely to be the best way of resolving it. You need to act as quickly as you can after an incident, and you must follow procedures. Usually, that means reporting the issue to your manager, unless they are the perpetrator, or human resources who are required to carry out an unbiased investigation. This can be an uncomfortable process, but if your complaint is justified, employment law will protect you. No decent or even merely up-to-date organization will sweep the matter under the carpet, especially after all the adverse publicity around badly handled cases. If you feel no one is taking you seriously, make a formal written complaint using your employer's grievance procedures. If this still doesn't work, the next step is to go to employment tribunal. That may sound very daunting. Free advice is available online, and the very act of starting the process may result in a successful resolution. I'm quite often asked if bringing a case to tribunal will affect future employability. Again, if it is justified and the claims are proportionate, it should not. Over a decade ago, a senior female executive sued the investment bank where she worked for £7.5 million, alleging sex discrimination and unequal pay. The extraordinarily high sum of damages sought, especially relative to the allegations, did not help her case, she lost, or the reputation of women in the city. One of the pivotal incidences involved her being asked to pour drinks for male colleagues on a flight in the company's jet. The tribunal found that she happened to be seated nearest the drinks cabinet, and that anyone who had sat there would have been asked to do the same. It's important to retain perspective. After that particular lawsuit, whenever I went to pour coffee in a meeting, the men present would rush up and take over. 8. Is it important to have a mentor? Did you have one? Do you have one? As we've seen, it is really important to have allies and advisors. They do not need to be formal mentors. Stuart Newton was de facto my early mentor, but we did not have a formal mentoring relationship. Look for at least one person who is senior to you, whom you trust, who has your best interests at heart, and whose opinion you value. I still have people I turn to, Sir Roger Carr, for example, who has always been very thoughtful and generous with his time. He and a couple of others have effectively mentored me through times of change in particular. Ultimately, you are leading your own life, but it is really important to have sounding boards and that reality check mirror. 9. Have you found that women don't support other women? Personally, I don't see much evidence these days of the Queen Bee syndrome, where one woman wants all the attention. I've benefited from female mentors, the late Dame Helen Alexander, former chief executive of the Economist Group, was described by its eponymous publication as relying on a quiet wisdom, listening, not lecturing, and I can vouch for that. While I was between jobs after Newton, Helen offered to meet, and after listening carefully to various ideas I was exploring, gave me the clearest sighted advice. She was adamant about where my strengths lay and quite determined that I should not settle for anything that didn't really play to those strengths. She helped me to make up my mind about my future, and I will always be grateful to Helen for being so genuine in her desire to help. The data confirms that women who are successful in business do look out for their female colleagues. Credit Suisse Research Institute's Gender 3000 report is unambiguous. Female CEOs are 50% more likely to have a female chief finance officer and 55% more likely to have women running business units. The perception that women don't look out for other women may emanate from the reluctance of some senior women to get involved in anything that looks like a campaign. I have seen that and think it's a shame, but understandable based on past perceptions of gender equality being regarded as a women's issue, not a business issue. Some of these women have become more involved as the agenda has shifted. Others have admitted that they thought progress would occur naturally. Dame Marjorie Scardino, the first female chief executive of a FTSE 100 company, said when she stood down in 2012 after 15 years, "I thought that by the time I left Pearson, things would be different in terms of how many women there were as chief executives or chairman or board members. It's not too different, and for that I'm sorry." Dame Marjorie revealed, "I have always thought it was not helpful to just pile women onto boards because they were women. I hope by now it's clear that the 30% Club never had any intention of doing that." 10. Do you think men need to change as well as women? Few of the men I know of my age or older would have been prepared to do what my husband has done, but I think that is related to expectations they grew up with about their role. As we have seen, this is changing. Young men today expect to have a different and more balanced life. I've been challenged about this. It's suggested that these young men are idealistic, and when they start work, they will quickly fall into line with past behaviours. But I am more confident. Already, men are much less proud of working long hours. That now seems less a badge of honour and more a sign of not being in control of their own destiny. The cool, really successful men work the hours they choose and have plenty of time for other activities. I'm writing this after talking to a colleague who works extended hours for 4 days to spend Tuesdays with his 3.5-year-old daughter. It's Monday today, and he has been talking about the day ahead with great enthusiasm, describing it as a highlight of his week. But while things are changing for men, again, as with women, we're not there yet. The UK government introduced shared parental leave in April 2015. Just 3,000 couples took shared leave in the first 3 months of 2016, compared with 155,000 mothers taking old-style maternity leave and 52,000 fathers on shorter paternity leave. However, companies have tended to treat men and women as different financially if they share parental leave. In June 2017, one father won a landmark sex discrimination case against his company over paternity pay, and this has prompted reviews of practices at other firms. I am convinced that many men want to play an active role in their children's lives, and I'd love to see high flyers blaze that trail and show that taking parental leave for a few months is entirely consistent with having a great multi-decade career. After all, why not? I am always happy to try to answer whatever is on girls' minds, but the one question I really want to hear that rarely comes up is, quite simply, how do I get to be the CEO? Chapter 8. Camp CEO. Girl Guiding research has found that 90% of 9 to 10-year-olds think that women and men have the same chance at succeeding in their jobs, but only 35% of 17 to 21-year-olds feel the same. Camp CEO is about changing that. From the Girl Guiding website, www.girlguiding.org.uk. In 2014, I was invited to speak at the UK Girl Guides Camp CEO. There I met some amazingly ambitious and impressive 14 to 17-year-old girls who had been through a rigorous application process to be picked for a week-long intensive course that included mentoring, challenges, and talks from female CEOs. I loved the concept, and not just because I enjoyed my time as a rather manic brownie when I drove my parents mad in my quest to break the regional record for the most badges. The very idea of a CEO boot camp reminded me that far too often, efforts to help women progress focus on everything except preparing them for that top job. Much of the advice doled out to women of all ages focuses on self-improvement. It's fine to be encouraged to be the best version of ourselves, but not to feel we have to change radically, or that we must walk along a narrow tightrope to succeed. Such advice erodes rather than builds our confidence. It's so easy to become focused on what we are doing wrong rather than what we are getting right. Sylvia Ann Hewlett has conducted groundbreaking research into a wide range of aspects of diversity, including gender. Her book, Executive Presence, explores the missing link between women's merit and their success. Sylvia suggests that female leaders have little attitude, and she describes the thin line women have to tread so as not to appear too aggressive or not assertive enough, too opinionated or shrill, or unable to command a room, too provocatively dressed or too frumpy, looking too young or looking too old. The barrage of do's and don'ts is exhausting. If we worry too much about these female appearance blunders, we might never get out of bed. Happily, having shown us what can go wrong, Sylvia concludes that simply looking polished and groomed is actually the most important appearance criterion for would-be female executives. It's time we women stop worrying about being too this or too that, and instead focus much more on getting the job we want. Let's assume a reasonable level of ability, qualifications, and an aptitude for hard work. No career advice can substitute for those attributes. One of the first steps is to celebrate what we do well and spend more time on the areas of our life that we enjoy. I include myself in that. There are a few things we can consciously do to help ourselves be happier and more accomplished in our own eyes. First, try really hard not to look over your shoulder and compare yourself with anyone else. Looking sideways gets us nowhere, and contentment is an absolute, not a relative state. Focus on understanding what works for you, including when you are at your most energetic and effective. Newspaper articles often make a point of referencing how early I and some other successful women get up in the morning as if that's part of a plan, but what they don't mention is that I have always been an early riser and early to bed. I cannot function intellectually past 9 p.m, and I do my best work in the mornings. Getting up early is part of my natural rhythm and annoys my family at the weekends, not a beating the competition strategy. A quick look through what's been written about me also reveals more than a few comments about my style of dress, often conveying surprise that I don't look like a senior city woman or a mother of nine, whatever she is supposed to look like. I do like pink, and I do like dresses, but before you picture me as a much older version of Elle Woods, Reese Witherspoon's fabulous character in Legally Blonde, I'm afraid the reality is much less exciting. The only statement I'm making in my choice of clothes is that we can be feminine without being frivolous. I do feel more powerful in my work dresses, colourful though they may be, and as we explored earlier, feeling that way means that I am in turn perceived as being more powerful. I took many years to reach that point and needed to escape my own crazy mirror when it came to my appearance. That mirror became especially warped in my teenage years. I was anorexic between the ages of 14 and 15. The distortions in my mind's eye were so acute that I thought I was fat when I weighed 5 stone, 32 kilogram. Now I can see my body more objectively, a long way from perfect, but quite lean and strong. After all, it has managed to produce all those children, and I know what suits me. My look involves simple dresses, often cut or coloured quirkily, unfussy but bold jewellery, and high heels that lift me up, both literally and psychologically. I rarely wear suits. Structured clothes feel like barriers between me and the world. That may sound odd, but I just don't feel comfortable on days when I have to wear a suit. So much for strong-shouldered power dressing. In the early days of my career, when money for clothes was scarce, my wardrobe was very limited, especially since the high street wasn't as great as it is now. These days I enjoy getting ready, although in fact it takes just a few minutes from top to toe, and then getting on with the real business of living. My simple formula is certainly not for everyone. One stylish friend, lawyer Tamara Box, has a different coloured pair of glasses to match every outfit. Another, Sean Westerman, an investment banker involved in the British Fashion Council, is wonderfully cutting edge. Daminga Beale, CEO of Lloyd's of London, dresses very confidently with particularly striking jewellery. FTSE 100 CEO Dame Carolyn McCall is a non-executive director at Burberry and often wears their great clothes. I love seeing what these powerful women are wearing, but their distinctive looks don't influence my own style. In areas of both style and substance, the key is to develop your own view, a strong inner compass to guide you in most situations and decisions, big and small. I once took part in a conference on economics and politics alongside Lord Forsyth, the former Secretary of State for Scotland, who explained that in Margaret Thatcher's government, long before the days of WhatsApp, texts, or even emails, ministers didn't need to be told how to respond to an unexpected development. The central view was strong enough for them to be able to react on message. As individuals, we need a similarly strong core. But much of the guidance given to women doesn't help us become more centered. Ironically, it's usually based on teaching us how to play the past men's game, just as men move on from that. Women in mid-career are bombarded with advice on how to network, how to be more assertive, how to dress for success. While we are doing all that, men are taking aim at the role they want. We are embarking on a much more convoluted route, sometimes without even knowing where we are going, so it's hardly surprising that we are more likely to get lost along the way. There couldn't be a better time to take a more direct approach. Having made some progress in the boardroom, the emphasis now is on encouraging the appointment of more women executives. It's not just a good time to be a girl, it's a great time to be a woman. If you want to be the CEO, or even just to progress to the next level, concentrate on getting on the bench, not on joining yet another women's network. But what does getting on the bench entail? I am a big believer in clarifying things, or establishing what's not clear, by writing them down. List the attributes of the role. Does it involve managing a team, presenting to clients, devising a business plan? And then consider which skills you already have and the ones you may be missing. Notoriously, women will list few skills and lots of gaps, so if you can't be fair to yourself, seek someone else's opinion. Then think about how to address any vital gaps, but don't even think about needing to close them all. Executive search consultants confirm what sounds like an exaggeration, that a woman may fulfill 8 out of 10 requirements for a job, but think she's not up for it, whereas a man might have 5 and believe it's rightfully his. Alongside this self-assessment, work out a plan to position yourself for the role in the eyes of those who will be making the decision. Do you have good exposure to them? Do they get to see what you can do? You need them to be thinking about you quite specifically as a strong candidate for the job you want, not just in a vaguely positive light. You need to signal your ambition overtly. People will think carefully about turning you down if you have made it clear that you want the role. It may be unfair, but those who take disappointments meekly are more likely to be disappointed. And most importantly of all, think about how you come across. Do you behave as if you are a leader, part of the future management team? Are you proactive with your ideas? Do you speak up, encourage your colleagues and operate as if you merit the next job? I have participated in many succession planning conversations where senior managers are considering who to put on the bench for their own role and their direct reports. The difference between those assessed as top talent and those who are simply regarded as capable usually comes down to how they conduct themselves. Don't worry that any of this sounds pushy. Studies like the 30% Club's Cracking the Code confirm that women tend to express our ambition ambiguously, and that gives very mixed signals to bosses looking for clues. Help them out here. This is not about acting like a man. It's about acting like someone preparing for the next role. So often, I've seen women being overlooked because it's assumed that they are not particularly interested, yet they have been waiting politely for someone to ask. And don't think you need to clone someone one step ahead of you to catch them up. Remember, there is a widespread understanding in business today that there are different ways of being effective. Being authentic is valuable. Your own natural abilities are the ones to develop, not someone else's. Good bosses love discovering great talent. It helps them and the whole business, and that's strong motivation for them to help you succeed. These suggestions demand a degree of optimism on your part. If we're optimistic, we expect to win, even games of chance, and we take risks, putting ourselves out there. What about the many women who feel disillusioned or dispirited as a result of the not-yet-equal workplace? The picture portrayed by surveys like Project 2840, or frankly by any group of mid-career women talking about their career experiences, is a sobering one. Discouraging workplaces take their toll. And women who stop working to focus on their young families or elderly relatives feel a different frustration. They may be keen to resume a career, but unsure if that's even possible or how to take the first step. Life blows such as divorce, illness, or separation may also have intervened, causing financial anxiety as well as emotional trauma. A quick glance at the pages in newspapers targeted at female readers suggests that more of us feel anxious and fulfilled in our 40s and 50s. If you are in this situation, the first goal is to break the negative spiral. I know that is much easier said than done. It is hard to pick ourselves up when we feel worn down. We need something good to happen to break the negative cycle, and that does not always occur at the moment we really need it. I have been very fortunate in my life, but still found it disconcerting when I stepped down as Newton's CEO. I had been at the company for such a long time, and had really grown up and older with my colleagues. It was quite hard to look ahead, and there were many days when I struggled to take my own advice. I knew I needed mental space to carefully consider the next phase, and I also needed to replenish my energy and enthusiasms. During this time of uncertainty, when my future was a blank page, I worried I would diminish, not grow. It was one of those punctuation points in life. How could I build on what I had learned? Those who've been through truly extreme life experiences have much to teach us. During this time of introspection, and quite by chance, I met a woman whose inner confidence shone brightly. After we had been talking for a while, she told me that a decade earlier she had been diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer and been given a very slim chance of survival. Now, every moment, every birthday, was a bonus, and she wasted no time at all, appreciating it as a precious gift. Our conversation quickly moved beyond the usual superficial small talk between people meeting for the first time. We talk in clichés of putting things in perspective when we hear about such experiences, but this stranger really did help me to think more clearly. I was wrestling with many feelings and practicalities, but they would all be much more likely to fall into place if I followed my inner compass, if I stayed true to my own principles. If I was open to possibilities, those possibilities would be more likely to arise. I also really wanted to enjoy the time with my family while I was at home. Walking my youngest daughter to school each day, having more leisurely conversations, catching up with friends, and savouring each birthday. There were 6 family birthdays during my 4 months break. As we enjoyed yet another cake the other day, we counted up the children's aggregate birthdays since Fitz was born. We are up to 148. That really is something to marvel at. The school attended by 3 of my daughters has a beautifully named enrichment program. This time of reflection was part of my enrichment, but what about the very practical issues of finding another job? Here my advice is simple. Even if you're relatively senior, do not rely on executive search firms to find you that next wonderful role. It may happen, but in my experience this would be a stroke of luck rather than a reliable plan. I was clear that age 50, I wanted another executive, full-time role, not the same type of management position I had just left, but to build something. Perhaps in another decade or so, I might be interested in non-executive roles. Many women tell me, and I'm sure the same is true for men, that they struggle to get meetings with the leading search firms. I knew many search consultants well, partly through their involvement with the 30% Club, and was encouraged that they were receptive. During our meetings, I outlined my clear goals. Over the next few months, I was shown a number of non-executive board roles, big charity jobs or opportunities to chair companies going through a private equity buyout. Several consultants were very enthusiastic, but I was not shown one single hands-on executive position by any of them. At the same time, a few people I knew who were involved in interesting ventures contacted me, and in some cases, I contacted them. Several offered me executive positions, including, of course, the role I was delighted to accept at Legal & General Investment Management, where my big ambition is to engage the nation in investing, to reach those who haven't invested before, particularly women and younger people. That really excites me. The role combines building something with trying to help people improve their financial health. Exactly what I wanted, an executive role that combines profit and purpose. But the process of finding what turned out to be a dream job was quite different to my expectations at the start. It was easy to talk to people I had worked with in various contexts, and everyone I contacted directly was very generous with their time, advice, and in some cases offers. As we find with so much of the conventional career toolkit, formal processes don't necessarily help us in reality, but those allies and mentors we have talked about really can. It's all about relationships, and it's important to prioritize building these over time. A sponsor, someone who goes further, who champions your career, is ideal, but usually only available to those who've already proven themselves, as the sponsor is putting their own credibility on the line. Remember, take it one step at a time, and the path will gradually open up. When I joined Legal & General, several young women proactively reached out to tell me how happy they were that I had joined the company. One email in particular summed up the universality of the challenges of working motherhood. I read your article in the Evening Standard titled Working Women, Get a Seat at the Table and Change the Culture. It was one of my best reads as yet because your story resonated with me, and the strength and understanding showed in your marriage meant a lot to me as a married mother of two. I started to think if she can do it, then I can, so thank you for inspiring me. At the time, I had applied to do my MBA, which I did, and finished last year. I even told everyone I knew about you, how you juggled a big family with working as the CEO of an asset manager. For me, from that day onward, I stopped being hard on myself, forever feeling guilty that I wasn't spending as much time with the kids, which, of course, hindered my ability to want to aim higher, as I felt more responsibility equals less flexibility, which would mean spending even less time with the family. In a nutshell, reading your article was a call to me to say, it's okay to aim high, find the right balance, and everyone will be fine. So, thank you very much. Let's talk about this big sense of conflict. Many women are not just worried about the impact having children will have on their career, but about the impact their career might have on their children. More than two-thirds of the female respondents to Project 2840 said they felt society expected them to prioritize family over work. In my view, this is only partly attributable to media pressure. The pressure also emanates from ourselves. Both attitudes and working practices have moved on a long way since I had Fitz in 1991. But the reality is that having children is not something to fit neatly into a busy life. It's complicated, emotionally and physically, and changes us, often in very good ways. Again, there are as many lives as there are people, as many childbearing experiences as there are mothers, but we share common strands of experience. Although Richard and I obviously had no fertility issues, I did not have straightforward pregnancies. My first pregnancy was especially difficult. I was underweight to start with, barely 46 kilograms, but lost rather than gained weight over the first 4 months through acute morning sickness. Mine lasted all day. Travelling into work was hard. I had to take a bus, then the underground, but couldn't make the train journey in one go, so allowed enough time to come up to be sick once, if not twice, during the journey. It was a tough time physically. Apart from a threatened miscarriage at 14 weeks, when I had to spend 2 weeks in bed, I kept working the same long hours throughout until diagnosed with preeclampsia, a condition where the mother's blood pressure rises to a dangerous level, and having the baby early. As I struggled through that first pregnancy, there was one other woman I could compare notes with at work. She was 10 years older than me and also expecting her first child. The company employed several hundred staff in London at the time. She was one of only two senior women, and I was in awe of her. Our coincidental pregnancies created a bonding experience. We were both nervous first-time mothers, and towards the end of the day, she would often come up to my desk from the floor where she worked, and we would discuss things like whether drinking coffee might affect the baby. Neither of us had any clue, and there was no search engine to help at the time. After both of us left the firm, our paths crossed several times, and at some point in our conversations we usually talked about our firstborns. As by far the junior person in that relationship, I really welcomed her reaching out to me. Much later at Newton, we introduced an optional buddy program to help expectant mothers, where they could choose to have a mentor who had been through the maternity leave experience and returned to work. The first stages of pregnancy can be a lonely time for women, with most of us wanting to have the 12-week scan before we tell anyone beyond our immediate family, yet often feeling at our worst during the first trimester. I talked about this with a young American woman I know well, who I'd seen in New York when she was around 2.5 months pregnant, expecting her first child. I had guessed there is something very telltale about how our bodies changed, but I hadn't said anything, although I was longing to congratulate her. When we spoke on the phone a couple of weeks later, and she started by telling me her news, I mentioned that I had thought so, and she then explained how awful she had been feeling, how she had tried not to let any evidence of the pregnancy show, how she had dealt with the pressures of that particular day when she had to give a speech. Her struggle was very familiar to me. We are also used to hearing sad tales of women who have suffered multiple miscarriages, but beyond their relationships are alone with their sorrow. I have had two, one very early, the other at 12 weeks, and found the aloneliness of my sadness very hard, especially trying to carry on at work, even on one occasion actually having the miscarriage in the office, as if nothing was happening. My adverse experiences may put you off. Please don't let them. Much is written about unobtainable role models, and I have been cited many times in such articles. I flicked through my youngest daughter's religious studies coursework the other day and was intrigued to find a worksheet entitled Jesus as a Role Model. I felt that rather settled it, that we needed a new concept, focus on inspiring without the pressure to emulate. I want to share the reality and encourage you to recognize that everyone has challenges. The key is to have a supportive environment and to be resilient or adaptable, but not aim to be superhuman. And the guilt thing, where to start? I have not overcome this, but it would surely make me less human if I did. It would be odd not to want to spend time with my children, not to miss them when I'm away, not to feel sad if they are upset when I'm leaving the house. Karen Peets, formerly president of BNY Mellon and the mother of now grown-up twins, offered some pragmatism at an event hosted by Lloyds Bank. She recognized the need to accept the decisions she had made, the path she was actually taking, rather than to keep wondering about other versions of her life. That enabled her to focus on her career while doing her best when she was at home, enjoying that family time, rather than regretting there wasn't more of it. Otherwise, we can end up feeling like we are failing wherever we are, and that is most definitely a recipe for unhappiness. One of the strangely reassuring aspects of having so many children is that even if I was at home, there wouldn't be enough parents to go around. The dynamic of a large family is inevitably quite different from a smaller one. There is an inbuilt network for a start. I love seeing the older children spontaneously help their siblings with their homework, with their friendship issues, with creative projects. As I'm writing this, two of the girls are in the room next door, and I can hear the 17-year-old patiently explaining long multiplication to her 10-year-old sister who struggles with maths. What's especially lovely is that I know the older girl has a lot of her own work to do, but is acting as if she has all the time in the world. They are perfectly normal children, and so there are plenty of scraps, but they are first and foremost a unit. Meanwhile, Richard and I have just been making the best of it, and sometimes we have to see the funny side of the many challenges. It is not at all unusual in our household to have a completely unanticipated task thrown at us early in the day. One morning, two of the children announced over breakfast that they needed to go to school that day in a Mexican dress and a Peter Pan costume, respectively. After mentioning as casually as I could the next time it might be useful to know in advance, I tried to think calmly. There was no point panicking, no point stressing our already rather chaotic morning further by complaining, and in the scheme of things, this was not exactly a major problem. I asked if anyone had any ideas. One child remembered a big straw hat that could work as a sombrero, another rummaged around and found a multicoloured poncho, and I located a brightly coloured cotton-tiered skirt. Luckily, our Mexican for the day has long, almost black hair, so that helped give the look some authenticity. As I've mentioned before, luck plays a part. The Peter Pan costume was more challenging, but as we talked about what we could use, we remembered a green hat with a feather that had been used for a Robin Hood outfit, unearthed some green tights, and then did our best to adapt a Christmas elf tunic. Not a prize-winning outfit, but good enough. And then we all had a good laugh about our reality TV-esque early morning challenge. When Richard and I had just a few children, I loved making special dressing-up clothes for them, efforts that were definitely labours of love rather than because I had any talent. Letting go of the perfectionist trait, just doing what we can, helps us to stretch to fit the tasks in front of us and to be less stressed. For much the same reason, I only write out our family schedule board one day at a time. A week or a month ahead would feel too overwhelming, with all the variables and contingencies. That doesn't mean we don't plan things like holidays. It's important to book ahead if your group number's 11 or 13 now that the eldest two have partners, or the vague outline of the next few weekends. But we do try to live in the moment and enjoy the present. It's obvious, but we can have a lot more valuable mental space if we don't waste energy on negative thoughts or agonize over everything. When I feel anxious, I frequently turn to someone else, usually my husband, but sometimes a colleague, friend, or one of the children. I've noticed that they love to help. Even if the subject is not really something they know much about, a kind word or a hug can help everything seem less onerous and put whatever we are wrestling with in perspective. There's one piece of advice I came across very recently that encapsulates what has made the difference for me between having a successful business career in the eyes of others and actually feeling happy and confident that I am making a valuable contribution outside as well as inside the home. Indian Hindu monk Swami Vivekananda said, "Take up one idea. Make that one idea your life. Think of it. Dream of it. Live on that idea. Let the brain, muscles, nerves, every part of your body be full of that idea, and just leave every other idea alone. This is the way to success. My idea is the big rebalance between men and women, something that has ramifications for my family life, for my roles in business, for the commentary and analysis and speeches I make, and yes, is the motivation behind this book. All roads lead back to this idea. It's obviously far from a new idea, but it often feels to me that people don't understand how powerful a genuine balancing would be, and my contribution is to try to change that. This is my perspective, perhaps my justification. What do my children think? I ask them for their views on being brought up in a family where the traditional parental roles have been reversed. A number of the children suggested that the experience of having many siblings, both brothers and sisters, had also influenced their thinking about gender. We talked too about whether they felt being a boy or a girl would have any bearing on their opportunities. Finally, I asked whether they saw any obstacles towards the goal of true gender equality. Their answers were consistent. Here are some extracts. Thoughts from the Morrissey children. Fitz, age 26. As far as the role reversal is concerned, Dad has always been a really stable presence. He's intellectually provocative, a good person to chat to and share things with. It was great for me that he was able to come to my matches. The other boys often had their mothers there, which was good, but I really loved having my father there. It's given me a sense of what to aspire to as a man. Dad's been a great role model for me in that sense, and you have been a role model in other senses. You have shown me it's possible to achieve so much by sheer force of willpower, by your desire to make a difference. I do think that seems more noticeable because you're a woman. Perhaps we wouldn't have been so aware of it if you were a man. I think the experience of having lots of brothers and sisters has also influenced my perceptions of gender issues. Everyone, girl or boy, has their own talents, but the girls and boys have different types of emotional needs. It's great to be part of a diverse group of people with our own talents. There's a certain creative synergy between us. For me as the eldest, I've liked having a sense of responsibility and leadership, and the awareness that I'm something of a role model for the younger ones. Inevitably, you and Dad have had to adopt a slightly more laissez-faire approach because there are so many of us. That has given us the space and freedom to create our own path, to follow our own things, to make our own choices. Clara, age 17. Having the traditional parent roles reversed means that we are encouraged to pursue our own interests and take risks regardless of gender norms or other people's perceptions. But it can also mean that sometimes I don't see you as much as I would like to. My impression is that being a girl might make it slightly harder to be taken seriously. There's a lot of emphasis on the issue in the media, which perhaps makes it seem quite difficult for girls, but actually I'm not so sure there is enough emphasis on preparing us well at school. I think the biggest obstacle to achieving gender equality is girls' lack of confidence, together with people in power not really seeing the need to change, or perhaps not wanting to change. Octavia, age 14. Having a mum and dad doing things differently shows that both men and women can do the same roles, have the same positions. It has influenced me. There are quite a lot of people in my year at school whose dads stay at home. You can do either or both. Having so many brothers and sisters has also shown me that people can do lots of different things, and it's not about their gender, but about what they can do. For example, Flo is a singer, and that is because she's good at that. Some people seem to think that girls might not be able to do certain things, that they're not capable of having a lot of power or making good decisions. But I think that reflects a male view of what power is, and that view is changing. When people think of who's in charge, many people think of men, because that's the way they have known things to be. As more women become involved, that will change. Tuppy, age 19. At school, particularly when I was very young, almost everyone else's dads were working rather than their mums, so I was always conscious that our family was different. I remember one of my teachers asking us all what our parents did, and I was the only one whose mother was the breadwinner. As I went through school, my friends' families became more diverse, and that included more of the mothers working. It's just become more normal. I don't feel that this means a less likelihood of me succeeding in my own career as a man. It's just going to be more equal than for previous generations. I expect my sisters and female friends will mostly have careers. Actually, the girls I know at university often seem more driven than the boys. For example, they focus on securing internships. As far as obstacles to achieving equality are concerned, the workplace obviously still has its problems in terms of companies providing men and women with equal opportunities, but I think those kinds of issues are being addressed more effectively than those relating to the perception of women, not just in terms of how men view women, but also how women view themselves. When I was talking to a few friends recently about the gender pay gap, one girl said that talkative boys are described as confident, whereas talkative girls are considered loud, in other words, annoying. Obviously, there's more to confidence than how much noise you make, but societal views like this can make girls feel that it's not their place to be assertive and lead from the front. Whilst a girl can try to be more confident and strive for success, I can imagine that feels pretty daunting when many men and women of older generations have narrow-minded perceptions of how girls should behave and carry themselves. Cecily, age 10. The boys sometimes want to do different things than us, so it sometimes takes us longer to work out how to do something altogether. Dad's really good at running the house, but it's nice when you're at home. Dad's good at getting us to school and places on time. We don't talk about equality much at school, but I would like us to. Lots of girls at school aren't very confident, and we need to solve that. Millie, aged 18. Having parents that challenge the stereotypes of male and female roles has shown me that role reversal is not only possible, but it works. In our family, we all depend on each other. And living side by side with so many people of the opposite sex has allowed me to appreciate our different qualities, but also made clear to me that we have a lot in common and we should be taking advantage of both our differences and the similarities. If I didn't have so many brothers and sisters, I don't think I would be able to appreciate other people's ways of thinking as much. We have had to learn to get on well and interact with lots of people and to work in a team. We have to act selflessly and appreciate everyone's distinct skills and personalities. I think a lot of people talk about gender equality and its importance, but few people put it into practice. People make subconscious assumptions, and having brothers and sisters has made me realize that sometimes we act like girls or like boys, but also we are all individuals, and we can explore what actually interests us. B, aged 8. I have seen you and Dad do things differently from other parents, but also there are other dads who collect people from school too, and some of the other mothers work. Her best friend's mother is a successful barrister. We never really talk about girls' inequality at school, but I hear about it at home. In the olden days, boys got to do more things and girls didn't get to do so much, and that needed to change, and most of it has changed, but not all of it, so things are not yet equal. People might think men are more powerful, but sometimes women can be better. I think I will be good at running a business. I think I will be a good boss, because I like to stand up for myself and to be in charge sometimes, and to do what I want when I want to. I don't think it will make a big difference that I am a girl. Theo, aged 12. I think having a mum who works and a dad at home has influenced me. I can clearly see that men and women can both achieve great things. If you didn't work, people might tell me that men and women cannot both achieve things. But I can see that many people in our family are achieving a lot, and it doesn't matter what gender they are. Tuppy has written a book, you are helping women who want to work, and you have worked very hard and you are writing a book. Flo is an excellent singer. Fitzy is doing a PhD. Dad has looked after us while you are at work and researched, etc. There are many different interesting and wonderful people in our family, and it seems odd that there aren't more families like us. I don't think our gender should make any difference to whether we succeed or not. The biggest obstruction to achieving equality between men and women is that not everyone agrees with everyone else. We live in a world where there are always some people with different opinions to others. We live in an argumentative world, and that sometimes gets in the way of just making things better for everyone. As well as noting the complementary nature of their siblings' skills, the children have, through necessity, learned the value of teamwork. One evening when Richard and I were about to go out, I heard the seven children who were at home arguing over which film to watch. They each wanted something different. I listened at the door, about to intervene, when I realized they were introducing a voting system. Each child had a first and second vote, and after a number of voting rounds, they settled on Ice Age, all happy, and seeming to have forgotten that only one of them had wanted that in the first place. It was lovely to realize that they had devised their own solution, working as a team. And it made me think again about the benefits of proportional representation. They also overcame any initial dominance by the eldest boy in the group, who had come up with the voting idea, but who in the end did not get his own choice and accepted the outcome quite happily. My eldest daughter Flo came home once from being interviewed about her music by a national newspaper. She casually mentioned over supper that they had asked her a lot about me. I gulped. This wasn't something we had ever discussed or rehearsed, and I wondered what she had said. When the article came out, it was encouraging to read her comments. She said I had given her an appreciation for doing the thing and not holding back. It's sad when women feel they have to choose between being a housewife or succeeding in their career. When women give themselves over completely to their children, it is amazing, but it can also be inspiring for the children when mothers can juggle working and family. My mum would never say it, but she is a great example of someone who can do both. She is special because she is my mum, but it shows that anyone can do it. Flo is absolutely right that anyone can do it. Diversity and inclusion begin at home. Chapter 9. Gender Equality. Good news for men and boys, too. Oh, it's delightful to have ambitions. I'm so glad I have such a lot. And there never seems to be any end to them. That's the best of it. Just as soon as you attain to one ambition, you see another one, glittering, higher, up still. It does make life so interesting. Anne of Green Gables by L. M. Montgomery. Quoting from Anne of Green Gables may seem an odd way to introduce a chapter on men and boys, but our ambition here is for two-way gender equality, a more glittering and higher-up goal than a sole focus on women and girls. Richard has always maintained that the logical extension of the efforts to create greater opportunities for women is that men will have more choices too. It's not a zero-sum game. But we still have narrow preconceptions about the role men should play. I was reminded of this when I asked our middle son, Tuppy, then aged 8, what he wanted to do when he grew up, and was momentarily taken aback by his answer, "I think I'll stay at home like Dad." The role of men in society has long been to focus on developing their careers, gain status and influence, provide financially for their families, and offer security as the family leader, the patriarch. That sounds blatantly old-fashioned, but the reality is that while men are now expected to participate more in family and domestic life, those are more additional than replacement expectations. How many times have you spotted weekend dads, just as I might be perceived as a weekend mum? Clearly alpha men, pushing buggies, taking older children to the park, throwing themselves into their fatherhood responsibilities with great gusto at the end of a long working week, often alone, presumably to give their wives and partners a break. It's difficult for men, too, to work out how to be modern, to be sensitive, yet also relevant and successful when that is defined quite narrowly in terms of status, earnings and power. I see many men genuinely desirous of change for women. Often men with daughters are particularly committed, but it does leave a question mark hanging over their own place in the world that is not always easy to deal with. My husband stopped working full-time in 1999, long before the current wave of intense focus on gender equality. He is a private person and understandably reluctant to have his observations and experiences used for entertainment purposes. There have been lots of opportunities to go on the radio or TV, but to date he has turned them down because they seem more for show than to help others. His perspective is an essential aspect of our family life and important to me and the children as individuals. His experiences have also foreshadowed the incomplete as yet evolution of thinking about how all our roles are in flux. We are now looking less at role reversal and more at sharing different aspects of what it takes to bring up a family, earn money and develop careers. The sharing arrangement is not static either, but likely to vary from one stage of our lives to another. Rather than making you hear my interpretation of Richard's views, he agreed to answer some questions directly. Before you hear what he has to say, I want to pay him a very big tribute. Richard volunteered to do what he does, but he needn't have made that move. He has a first-class philosophy degree, something that eluded me, from Trinity College Dublin, and is incredibly well-read. He would say modestly that's because he has more time than most people, which is an interesting thought in itself. Why are people too busy to read? He has a powerful set of messages and ideas about his experiences to convey, and I am grateful to him for sharing them. Here is our interview. Helena. It was an unusual step to offer to go freelance and play a bigger role in the upbringing of our children. What were your reasons for doing that? Richard. At the time, I felt as if I had completed my current career path, which is unusual as I was only 35. But I experienced a strong pull to start afresh and live a different kind of life, one where I could contribute to our family in a more meaningful way and be more true to myself. In itself, freelancing was not then and is not now unusual for a man, but I did think at the time it might be a means of transitioning to a different path. It was obvious to me that I had reached a ceiling in terms of what I could achieve in journalism, intellectually and financially, whereas your path was much more open-ended, with fewer limits and greater potential earning power. Helena, are you happy with the way it worked out, for you, rather than the impact on me or the family? Richard, yes, I am happy with how it has worked out for me, but I can't really separate me from how it has worked out for you and the family. Judging success or happiness involves many factors, and the happiness of others is very important to me, so I am happy when I feel I have been a positive and supportive influence for our family together. However, with the children now growing up and starting to move on, I feel I must consider how I might do things differently over the next few years. There is a time for everything, and it's important to know when to make changes. It will be 20 years of this life soon, so I feel I need to explore what's next. I already feel poignant about seeing the children moving on, so I need to ensure there is not a vacuum in my life. You and the children are my life, so that is a big thing, and I need to work with it. A week later, our eldest daughter Flo and her boyfriend Benjamin told us the exciting news that they're expecting a baby, our first grandchild, creating a new dynamic around Richard's future. Helena, what are the aspects you haven't enjoyed? Richard, it has felt lonely at times. It's as if I'm living between two worlds. I'm neither a housewife with friends and a yoga practice, nor a man in the public domain, working and earning a living and playing golf with colleagues. And yes, it has sometimes been aggravating and frustrating for me. I have felt a mismatch between my insight and understanding and my capacity to use that in the world outside our family. I have been helped by being able to help you and some others feel the power within and to be in turn a happier person and indeed happier about yourself. So it's not that I don't enjoy what I do. It is more that it feels like I am less defined and conventional, so I have to explain or account for myself to people who don't know me. That can be tedious, but it's not a big deal in the scheme of things. Helena, do you think our arrangements have been beneficial for the children, for the family as a whole? What have been the challenges? Richard, yes, I do think our arrangements have been beneficial, very beneficial. I think the children are good-hearted people and well-balanced, mostly, and they are happy. I feel we both have provided them with great stability and a feeling that they have our support to find their own way in life without being too controlled or driven by us. They have the space to make so-called mistakes without the world falling in on them. I think it has been valuable for them to know that with you at work, I am always around and will work to keep a relatively stable and balanced environment for all of us. I have initiated various routines over the years. Cocktail time, before you call social services, this is actually crisps and raw vegetables at 5 p.m. served in a special segmented bowl. Sitting down time, our shorthand for saying enough jumping around, time to gather quietly on the sofa. The repetitive airing of favourite TV shows, Dad's Army, Jeeves and Wooster, Modern Family. Rituals like joining in the clap on the Friends introductory theme tune, and so on. I think that's provided some certainty for the children over many years and a sense of belonging in a world that can be very unsettling and confusing. Helena, are you surprised that nearly 2 decades later you are still one of the very few men we know who has a non-traditional role? Why do you think it's proving so hard to shift expectations about how men and women should spend their lives? Richard, I'm not surprised, but it is more nuanced than it was 20 years ago. There are more men working in flexible jobs and who are self-employed, so that allows them to be more involved with their family, which is a positive. But there are not many men who just look after the family. Even I tell people I'm also a meditation teacher. I think being a parent in our society is not seen as a meaningful full-time role, especially for a man, given the lack of income. Our society is driven by wins, striving, pushing forward, public success, and this success is often measured by financial power. Our world has to date been very vertical, not horizontal. I'm horizontal. That may be changing with the next generation of both boys and girls expecting something different, with technology broadening power across networks, rather than it being from top to bottom. I think people are happier and more productive when there is less hierarchy, and I'm sure our children will be able to work like that. Companies are seeing, perhaps a bit late, that flatter structures make more sense today. We live in a very public world, and being at home is a more private, secluded place now, especially as many women also work. So the people who are at home are a smaller group than in the past, both men and women. In other words, the role, already rather subordinate in the eyes of many, is diminishing importance, especially as there are now many nannies or other childcare providers. It's certainly not seen as being in any way powerful, even though we play a big role in bringing up the next generation, which is in its way quite a responsibility. And that's harder for men when we are conditioned to make our way